Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
Today, we are joined by a very special guest, and we're so excited to have her on the show that I think I'm going to skip through my typical wind-up and just get straight to welcoming Michelle Flournoy. Michelle, welcome to Brussels Sprouts.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'll do maybe a little bit of a more formal introduction and then turn it over to Jim, who I think will want to say a few more personal words. But this is such a great moment for Brussels Sprouts because, as many of our listeners know, Michelle is the co-founder and former president and CEO of our organization, the Center for a New American Security, and she's currently a board member. She's also a leading voice in the national security community. She served in several senior positions at the Defense Department, including as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2009 to 2012. And she's currently a managing partner and co-founder of West Exec Advisors.
And I also want to just throw in and say how, on a personal basis, how great it is to have Michelle here. I don't know if you know this, Michelle, but I remember when you first set foot in the Pentagon, I was right down the hallway from where you all landed when you came in with the Clinton administration. So I've known you for a long time, and it's great you're here. But I did think that those who are our rabid fans of Brussels Sprouts, they need to know that when we started Brussels Sprouts, the godmother for Julie and myself was Michelle. She let us do this. This was something new. Julie and I were trying to really push the envelope out. And one of the things I wanted to do was to have mugs. And there were a lot of raised eyebrows around CNAS, which is a pretty, you know, pretty tight group. And they were saying, what are these mugs? And Michelle did not bat an eye. She forwarded us the money. We brought in the mugs, and now they are highly collectible across Europe and the United States.
Highly collectible. They are coveted items in our community for sure. We've got lots of different pictures floating around on Twitter with people, different people with the mugs.
So just for all so you of know, you, I covet one of those mugs, so you know where to send the next one.
we'll bring a couple of them. So, Michelle, something that we have been talking about quite a bit here. Both Andrea and myself and among our little team is thinking about the NATO ministerial that is just winding up in Brussels. And if you were Mark Esper, what would you say to all those perm reps around the table, not just about U.S. forces potentially leaving Germany or civ-mil relations, but what would you say about the United States, about America? I mean, for me, thinking of myself as a perm rep, if I went and sat down at a NAC meeting, my first NAC meeting, I think there are a lot of things my perm rep colleagues want to hear from me. And one certainly would be a perspective on where the United States is in this era that has come upon us. And just what would you say if you were talking to your NATO colleagues about the United States now?
Well, I think this is a moment when we have a lot of rebuilding of trust to do with our NATO allies. And so I would encourage the Secretary to be totally candid and acknowledge the challenges that we are facing as societies, as democracies, and to reaffirm the commitment to the shared values that are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, but also in the founding documents and ideals of many European states. You know, things like equality and justice for all. So I would acknowledge that the U.S. has some serious lessons learned work to do in terms of the mishandling of the pandemic. We obviously, you know, there will be pandemics in the future, and we obviously want to be more successful in handling the next one. But there's also very serious work to do to address issues of systemic racism and injustice in our society. And that's not unique to the United States. I think this is true in many Western European countries as well. So I think we need to invest in the strength and resilience of our societies and our democracies as the foundation of our collective security. So I would encourage the Secretary to have a very frank and candid discussion that tries to rally our allies and build trust with them, you know, by acknowledging the challenges that we, the very serious challenges that we're facing.
Maybe if we stay at home just for another minute, I know we definitely want to talk about transatlantic ties, but if we stay at home for another minute, just this broader question about kind of what the pandemic's effects will be on the Department of Defense and defense spending, and also what it will mean for the way that Americans are thinking about national security. And I mean, I wonder, you know, in your mind, do you think it's possible that Americans' conceptions and definitions of what national security is will shift? Will people be more attuned to and maybe place greater emphasis or priority on more transnational threats, global health, climate? And what do you think that might mean then for defense budgets going forward, particularly in the US?
So I do think that we're at a moment where we're likely to see a broadening of the definition of what counts as national security or what should be included. I mean, we're living through now a pandemic that has touched the lives of just about every American in the country. And so pandemic prevention is going to be on everybody's mind. And when we talk about protecting Americans, they're going to expect that to be high on the list. When you look at the polling of the next generation, the younger generations of Americans, when you ask them what's the primary national security threat, they say climate change, because that is going to really impinge on the future that they see for themselves and for the world. And so I do think we're going to have to reckon with the fact that we have to look at national security more broadly and include a whole variety of transnational threats, even as we recognize we're in this very competitive period with other great powers, particularly China, and to a lesser extent, Russia, in terms of its capability. But so yes, I do think that will affect spending. You have a lot of people talking about what would a national security budget look like? How do we, and unfortunately after this administration, we'll have a lot of rebuilding of the non-military tools to do, as well as a sharpening of the military's edge. But you know, you're gonna have to rebuild the State Department, you're gonna have to bolster USAID, we're gonna have to readapt information instruments so that we can try to influence counter the propaganda that's out there, the disinformation that authoritarian states are using against our democracy and our interests. So there's a lot of work to be done, which means that, and with all the pandemic spending and the economic crisis we're in, there will be pressure on the defense budget, to be sure. And I would say just, and that would be in any administration. Whoever wins the election, the pressure on defense spending as 50% of discretionary spending will be severe.
You just touched also on something I wanted to talk to you, and that's that frame of great power competition. And that frame is here to stay. But it's a strategy that so far has talked about both Russia and China as our most significant competitors. But you just touched on, you know, whether or not maybe we need to make more distinction of where the focus is. And it's clear that China is the focus, but I think you do see a little bit more debate on in the Russia community. Some who will say that framing great power competition and putting Russia up on the same pedestal near China kind of overstates the threat from Russia. But there's also, I think, an equally vocal group who are concerned that kind of a laser-like focus on China might actually overlook the risks that Russia poses. And so I guess I'd just love to hear your thoughts about, in that frame of great power competition, how do you think about Russia?
Yeah, no, I think it's very important to distinguish between the challenges we face with China and the challenges from Russia. You know, the Chinese competition is multidimensional. It's first and foremost economic, technological. There's an ideological component or political component, and then of course a military component. And what we do to deter China may look very different or require different things than what we need to do to deter Russian mischief. Russia is, by all objective measures, arguably a declining power. But it is very dangerous because of Vladimir Putin and his love of the KGB playbook, which he uses with abandon on a daily basis, and because he invests quite seriously in his aspects of his military, his nuclear arsenal, and so forth. So we can't afford to ignore Russia, but I think the strategies that we adopt to deal with Russia, particularly in the gray zone and in the European theater, it's not completely different challenge set, but I think it serves our efforts better to think about the uniqueness as opposed to just lump them both together and assume that what we do to China will be adequate to deal with Russia. And unfortunately, you know, the U.S., there are a lot of challenges out there, and we don't get to pick and choose which ones we can ignore. What we have to do is prioritize, which is the fun part of strategy, and then do the hard part of strategy, which is decide what are you going to deprioritize or where are you going to accept and manage a degree of risk.
You know, as we look at Europe and we look at China and Russia, I also try to think of Europe in terms of the European nations themselves, the allies. And this isn't so much a question about NATO, but just a feel about dealing with it, with Europe. Because I think in a lot of ways, the Europe that will be that the next president is going to face is going to be a different Europe than we've seen over the past couple of years. I think there has been a move in a lot of capitals, but also among Europeans that they don't want to have this dependence on the United States the way it was, and that Europe needs to stand on its own feet, that there needs to be a stronger European pillar. How they actually do that is another question. We watch them struggle with PESCO and things within the European Union, but what do you think the next Europe is going to look like for the next president? What do you think we'll be dealing with? Maybe more of an equal partner than has been in the past.
Well, I think that, you know, if President Trump leaves office and you have a new President Biden who is much more attuned to the value, the strategic value of the transatlantic alliance, and who is going to immediately invest in trying to recover, you know, reverse some of the damage done to those relationships, really embrace our European allies as critical strategic partners, not only for dealing with European issues, but for dealing with global issues, to kind of build up a more of a coalition of democracies, if you will, to deal with some of the threats from authoritarian states. You know, I think that there will be almost certainly a big sigh of relief in many European capitals. But I don't think we should kid ourselves to think that, okay, then all the problems will be solved.
Right.
Because I think most European leaders that I speak to see President Trump not just as a unique, anomalous individual, but as a product or symptom of something very deep that's happening right in the United States. And so I don't think we will be able to fully, you know, win back their trust in our commitment, our credibility, our predictability, our sort of constancy, until they see another president elected who also recommits to NATO. You know, I think we're all for a stronger European contribution to defense. I mean, the last speech I helped, and you did too, Secretary Gates work on, was a very stern message to NATO that they've got to do more to pull their weight. But this notion of sort of beating up allies on one metric, which is percent of spending, 2% of GDP on defense spending, is offensive in the sense that we're beating up allies who've shed blood alongside us in places like Afghanistan. We're beating up allies who are sending troops every day to the Baltics to shore up deterrence against Russia. We're beating up on allies who are helping to finance important priorities like, you know, supporting the development of Afghan national security forces or the counter-ISIS coalition. So we need to take a more holistic view and to look at all of the contributions that various allies make. We need to encourage their capability development and putting more money into what they need to deter Russia and other missions. But we need to try to keep the close relationship even as we do that.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's something I think a lot of us on the outside have been thinking about. And I think that if there were to be a new administration, I think that would be a great, that would be received actually quite well when the Alliance to sit down and let's rethink the 2%. Let's rethink how we look at ally contributions. What do we mean by burden sharing? And I think that would be a good
thing. I would rethink the 2%. I would just not make it the only metric.
Right.
I think the Alliance needs stretch goals to
right.
get these very well, for relatively speaking, to the, you know, wealthy economies to do more on defense, given the nature of the threats we face in the world. But it's that shouldn't be the only metric.
Right.
I want to ask maybe two questions kind of on Russia and China in the context of the transatlantic conversation, but maybe starting with the Russia one. And that's kind of the more general question on how do you think we're doing on deterrence? I mean, some of the news that we've had most recently has been a series of announcements that kind of suggest that the arms control regime is unraveling. So INF is no more. We are pulling out of open skies. You know, still an open question about what happens with New START. We just recently had the announcement about US reducing its troop presence in Germany. So there's been kind of a series of concerning announcements, I would say. But when you look at the bigger picture, do you think that, you know, what do you see as kind of the trend line, or how do you think we're generally doing on the deterrence front in Europe vis-a-vis Russia?
So I think it's a mixed picture. I think because of the European reassurance or deterrence initiative, and the way that NATO countries have stepped up, particularly on, you know, on the Northern Front, I think conventional deterrence in Europe right now is quite strong. So I don't, you know, go to sleep at night worrying about that. I think where we are, we've seen some erosion or inability to really sort of crack the code on how to strengthen deterrence is in the gray zone. So below the level of conflict, looking at that KGB playbook, you know, the use of propaganda, the use of disinformation, cyber attacks, little green men, intelligence operations, and so forth. That's where Putin is still seems to feel that he has a fairly free hand to make mischief, to try to undermine our democracies, and kind of create a zone of instability or some sphere of reestablish some sphere of influence along his periphery. And then again, at the higher end, I think nuclear deterrence is holding, but I do think this administration is playing with fire to contemplate not renewing the New START treaty. It is a treaty that provides a framework of strategic stability. It's not perfect, but it is better, certainly far better and far more in our interest than letting it go. It is a basis on which we can then negotiate further arms control, and maybe we should bring in China down the road, but we shouldn't allow Beijing to determine whether or not we're going to keep a strategic stability framework with Russia. This is an area we need. I think if you polled the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if you polled all of our senior intelligence professionals to a person, they would say absolutely keep New START because we get better intelligence, we have better predictability, and we have lower risk of instability in the nuclear domain.
And then following up kind of the second part of this question is kind of the China piece, a newer issue in the transatlantic relationship. And we saw the Secretary General give a speech earlier this month that really put China front and center of the NATO discussion. And I think it is getting harder for the alliance to ignore. We're seeing Beijing's growing footprint in the Arctic, in Africa, in cyberspace, potentially in 5G. You also have the increasing joint exercises between Russia and China. And so how do you think about China in the transatlantic context? What threats or risks do you think it poses to NATO? And what would you like to see Europe do to help the United States to work together to address a rising China?
So I think the biggest mistake that the Trump administration has made in approaching the competition with China is to approach it unilaterally and to focus primarily on tactical, transactional, you know, tit for tat actions like the imposition of tariffs. I think we will be much more effective competing with China, first if we invest in the drivers of our own competitiveness here at home, R&D, science and technology, 21st century infrastructure, smart immigration policy, and we can all go through, that's another podcast. but second is to gather and build and lead a coalition of like-minded states, including our European partners, to push back on China collectively, because we all have the same trade issues, intellectual property theft issues, lack of a level playing field for our firms in China. We have the same problems with China. We will be much more effective if we band together to put pressure on China together, to show up together at standard-setting bodies around the world, to set the rules of the road for trade, for technology, and so forth. So I think beefing up the economic and technological cooperation aspects of the transatlantic relationship will be really, really important to be effective vis-a-vis China going forward.
You know, on that point, I've been thinking about something that I didn't used to like, and now I'm starting to think that maybe a division of labor might be smart. And in other words, allies sometimes ask, well, should we be ready to send troops to Asia? Should we send ships to Asia? And I said, I'm starting to think that really what we want you to do is to have a strong conventional defense in Europe so that you free us to play more of a role in Asia. That's what you can really do to help us. And I think that might be something we should think more about and maybe do a little exercises and plan and see if that's actually workable.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think, frankly, they'll get more public support for that kind of approach than they would trying to convince their, you know, their people that they have to send troops or ships to Asia. The one thing I will say is on the technology front, you know, when our CFIUS rules or our export controls actually prevent China from gaining access to key technologies, cutting edge technologies that we're developing here, the next place they go is either Israel or the somewhere in Europe. And so that's the back door and the window if they can't get through the front door. And we have to have a lot more discussion and not just view it through the tactical competitive lens of, you know, a European country saying, hey, oh, we'd rather have this business from China and their direct investment than letting it go to the US, but to have a little bit more of a strategic discussion about, you know, if it's a dual-use technology, if it has military applications, we need to pay attention together, and we need to approach constraining Chinese access together.
You know, I really like hearing that. We have let things like the ITAR and AI releasability and things like that have so gummed up right now that industrial relationship between the U.S. and Europe and with the allies. It's reached a crisis point, and we need to untangle things. And I think what you just laid out would be a great step to begin to kind of have them look on them as partners in this, and not have them look on our initiatives as if it's Buy America. That's not what we're talking about. We've got to work together to somehow be better partners than we are now. Less competitiveness in a sense, and more cooperation.
Yeah, hard at a time when there's, you know, economic pressure in Europe as well. There's a lot of protectionist instincts coming up. There's a lot of rising nationalism. So, you know, this is a place where really engaged strategic dialogue and diplomacy and economic coordination becomes really important. And it gets back to, you know, reinvesting in the primacy of diplomacy and our economic influence in our foreign policy. And not, you know, focusing only on the security dimensions. As, you know, I'm the first one to argue how important those are. But, you know, going forward with Europe vis-a-vis China, the economic and the technological pieces are absolutely critical.
I think Brussels Sprouts listeners might get tired of hearing me ask the same question, but it's only because we are continuing to work on a project on the bilateral relationship between Russia and China. And so kind of I've kind of been talking about each of those. And I think we have a general understanding of what the risks and challenges that Russia pose, the risks and challenges that China poses. but we are in seeing increasingly increasing alignment between the two of them, deepening ties across virtually every dimension of their relationship. And in my mind, that alignment kind of creates some synergies that may actually go above and beyond what the two challenges that they pose individually. But I just love to hear your thoughts on how you're thinking about their bilateral relationship, whether it's something that you think is concerning, whether you think it's something that a future Department of Defense is going to have to take into account as they're doing some of their defense planning.
I certainly think that we have to pay attention and watch the relationship between Russia and China carefully. My own assessment at this moment is that it's not a strategic alliance. There's a lot of internal tension between the two. Russia gets particularly irritated that, you know, China doesn't see them as an equal. They see this as a, you know, we'll deign to work with you when it's in our interest to do so. I think there's a lot of fear in parts of the Russian think tank community anyway, in terms of, you know, not of kind of losing control in some areas where China may choose to go for primacy. That said, they have certainly shown that they can opportunistically find areas of to cooperate, usually on a more ad hoc or tactical basis, but that can cause real problems for us, particularly if that cooperation became more regular and institutionalized. And whether that is something as simple as ganging up against us in the UN, to each opportunistically using distraction that we may have with the other to advance their objectives. So we've seen in this pandemic and the economic crisis, China be very opportunistic in testing the boundaries in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, vis-a-vis Taiwan, now with the border of India. Similarly, I think, you know, that's something Putin does very well. When we seem distracted, when we're preoccupied with China or something else that's going on, he'll show up and do something in the Middle East or wherever, in the Mediterranean or wherever. So I think we have to watch it. I don't see it as a strategic alliance, but I think there are limits to their cooperation, but they could certainly create additional headaches for us if we don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe I'll do one more question before we get to Jim's favorite final questions. But I did get the chance to tune in and hear you speak yesterday, I think at your Carnegie session, where you were talking about prioritization and kind of what you think future priorities for a new administration would be. And so we've already talked a lot about China, but what are some of the other issues that you would put at the top of your priority lists if you think there would be a change of administration come November?
Well, again, as I said, I think the number one thing we need to do is reinvest in the drivers of our own technological and economic competitiveness, because that is the foundation for our influence, for our ability to resource the rebuilding of all of our instruments, the non-military instruments, and it will be the foundation of our military's ability to invest in the new and emerging technologies that will be essential to deter a rising power like China, and also have applications in deterring Russia. So I think that's thing number one. Thing number two is, I think, we will have a lot of competing domestic priorities for understandable reasons, and those do need to be priorities. But it's also a time that we cannot afford to neglect our national security or retreat from the world. We need to adopt that broader definition we spoke about that includes a number of transnational threats. I think the name of the game is shoring up deterrence. Tailoring deterrence that we need against China, tailoring it against Russia, tailoring it against Iran, North Korea, and so forth. But to really re-energize our diplomacy, to be showing up in the key fora, to be leading the building of coalitions and that can bring together additional capacity to go after shared goals, and to convincing the American people that that's essential to protecting them from these various threats going forward. Very hard choices will have to be made, but I think with the right leadership and the right judgment and a much deeper partnership with Congress, it's possible. I have to be an optimist by nature. Yeah. I can't get out of the bed in the morning.
We try.
Without being optimistic.
Yeah. Jim, over to you.
Well, this is the signal that we're wrapping up, and that's this question that I love to ask some of our guests that have had long careers and very fulfilling and substantive careers like you have. I always like to try to have our guests reflect a little bit about what they have kind of learned over time. Because we all arrive in Washington with preconceived notions, and we arrive thinking things are going to be one way. And then as our careers go and we work our way up and we have some incredible experiences, we reach a point where we look back and we say, you know, I didn't think it was going to be this way when I started. And then you certainly can see that in whether it's policies that you thought were going on, or the way business is done in government, or the way things are on a personal basis in terms of work-life balance, or in terms of what you thought you'd be doing now when you first started off versus what the reality is. So what are the kind of the great truths, in a sense, that you've kind of come upon at this point in your career, some interesting observations that you didn't think quite were going to be that way, but in fact are?
I would say one thing that I didn't fully understand early in my career that is sort of a foundational rock for me now is the impact that you can have on people. Yeah. Investing in people, whether it's the peers on your team, whether it's next generations coming after you. I mean, when you come out of an administration and the subsequent administration goes through a systematic deconstruction of everything you worked so hard on, you know, and you're saying, well, you know, what really matters? Where can you still have impact? For me, it's been doubling down on investing in people and on future generations of national security professionals, and notions like the idea that our national security cadre should actually look like America. Right. And when we open up and include and create more diversity, you're actually enormously growing the size of the talent pool, and you're going to get better quality people, and you're going to get better quality results for the country.
Right.
In terms of quality of decision making and performance, which, you know, every, you know, Harvard Business School or Harvard Business Review article that looks at corporate decision making says diverse teams make better decisions, have better bottom line performance. So,
right.
So for me, that's something that no one can take away from you, right?
Yeah.
The policy can be changed, you know, whatever, all kinds of other things can happen that are very hard accept. But when you invest in people, whether they're your teams, your peers, and the next generations, that's invaluable. And I think, again, since we're talking on a CNAS podcast, I'll just mention that one of the people who did this incredibly well and in a defining way was Sean Brimley, who at the age of 40, when he passed away far too young, had mentored dozens and dozens and dozens of people in this field. So it's a great lesson for all of us.
Yeah, so true. And I mean, you've obviously instilled all of those ideas in our organization and the commitment to the next generation. So hopefully we're kind of, you know, keeping your legacy alive, not that you're gone, but gone from CNAS, and keeping your legacy alive with our investment and our interest in trying to grow the next generation.
I think it's been a big differentiator for CNAS since the start, and you guys are doing a great job of amplifying it.
Yeah. Well, this has been really a tremendous conversation. I mean, it's such a difficult time. It's hard to wrap your head around everything that's happening around us. And I think just hearing from people like you, kind of how you're thinking about things and making sense of things, is such a tremendous service for all of us. So we really appreciate your time and for joining Brussels Sprouts.
Yeah, thanks for including me, and I hope I've earned my mug.
You definitely earned your mug. We're going to figure out how to get one to you.
Yeah, thank you so
Michelle.
Much.
Take care and stay well.